Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
And he would just search for years, walking all the tracks, going off the tracks. It can just consume them.
I was the last one that probably ever saw them alive, and I've never told anybody.
They've obviously been digging, and I've just pulled a bone out. There's a piece of bone right here.
From Brevity Studios, I'm Ryan Wolfe, and this is Guilt. Who was Detective John Hughes? As you should all be aware, Hughes was the lead detective in Operation Stockholm, investigating the murders of Heidi Parkkinen and Urban Hoglan in 1989. In 2006, Hughes passed away after a battle with cancer. Over 1,000 people attended his funeral. His New Zealand Herald obituary described a man who throughout his career worked on more than 40 murder cases, for which he acquired a reputation for unrelenting investigation. And this doggedness can be seen throughout many aspects of Hughes' life. In 1976, he was declared the Herald Sports Star of the Week after he smashed Max Telford's Auckland to Hamilton road race record by 32 minutes, completing it in a time of 9 hours and 47 minutes. A few years later, he took more than a day off the Sydney to Melbourne run record, 864 kilometres in 7 days. When he retired in 1992, when queried about his methods throughout his career, he replied, some criminals did not respond to tea and cucumber sandwiches. In the 1950s, Hughes won the New Zealand light middleweight boxing title for 3 successive years, and it was during this amateur boxing career that Hughes came into contact with the notable name I'll be speaking to today, Sir Bob Jones.
Have you got a drink? Oh, you want
yeah,
water?
Yeah, Leachy got me a water. Do you want a glass?
No.
I'd love to go back and chat about how you met Johnny and that whole...
Sure.
Yeah, I suppose would it start...
Are we filming this?
Oh, it's just on audio.
Oh, right. Okay,
so,
yeah.
So don't say anything that you don't want.
No, that's all right. You see, I was so embroiled in boxing.
Yeah, tell me about how you got started in boxing.
Oh, it's the best thing that ever happened. Probably the second best thing that ever happened to me.
When he says, obviously, this thing is the second... Bob casually waves his hand to point out our surroundings. Right now, I'm sitting beside Bob at his desk, notably free of any computers or phones. Bob's actually never owned a mobile phone in his life. His desk sits flush with the large upper-story window of an impressive central Wellington high-rise office building. One of 20, his business Robert Jones Holdings Limited owns in Wellington alone. I'm very privileged to have this opportunity to sit and have a candid conversation with Bob. He's a very busy man, managing over $2 billion worth of real estate over multiple countries. Bob is incredibly well-spoken, widely read, and doesn't suffer a fool. Today, the National Business Review places Bob as number 10 on New Zealand's rich list, with a personal net worth of approximately $1.1 billion. and he was once polled to be New Zealand's third most recognisable person. In mid-2023, on learning of Bob's relationship with John Hughes, I reached out, and he kindly invited me to Wellington for this interview. When I asked about how he met Hughes, who Bob refers to as Johnny, he tells me the story really begins with his upbringing in post-war Wellington.
Well, I'm growing up in State House, Lower Hutt. And I listened to people going on about hardship today, but, you know, we had no relativities. This was our norm. My father worked for 7 days a week for 3 years and 4 nights overtime. We never saw him as kids. In Upper Hutt, he left school at 12. My mother left school at 12. It was quite normal then. And this is in the post-war years. And he was a welder, but he was working in the Dunlop factory. He couldn't have been a welder there. He must have just had a factory job. But in any event, then he went back, then he went down finally to 6 days a week. Wages were incredibly low in relative terms, you know. And, I mean, when I started school at five, I walked 3 miles along the high street to school. Well, you could probably arrest a mother for that today, with good reason. But then there were no cars, there were no buses, there were no bloody trucks because nobody could afford to buy anything. There were no vans delivering things, you know what I mean? There was no traffic. So I walked along there. I remember, I have a lot of pre-war memories, you know, P5-year-old memories, but, and of course also there were no blokes lurking around everywhere. If you didn't work, you starved. But I had a close mate who was a boxing family fella. He ultimately became a pro himself. Two of his brothers did this sort of thing. It was a very big thing in the post-war years. And I'll never forget going up there. Tuesday nights, Thursday nights, running 3 miles up there. It was just a wonderful world. And it, you know, with these old pros and this sort of thing, wonderful, wonderful world I entered into. It was also incredibly character forming because it's a very lonely place. You can't throw a tantrum and throw your tennis racket away and walk off. Yeah, and there's somebody opposite you. But we were little boys dancing around, jabbing one another. The old pros hanging out there, oh, very good, Bob, you know, and all that sort of thing. And I loved it. I just loved it. I know a lot about boxing. I've written a lot about it. And I ran boxing here for a long time, managed fighters, all that sort of thing, which I hate doing. But, I mean, I was the only bugger in Ali's dressing room after the Thriller in Manila, only outsider. I mean, I don't want to divert too much, but I really got embroiled in the boxing world all over the world and was well known for it. And I've walked away now, it's full of shit now, with bogus titles and championships. I mean, as a boy, you know, we were obsessed with it, and my mates and I. We could recount all 8 world champions and who they won the title of going back to the 1880, 1890. And now, of course, they keep creating new weight divisions. There was a justification in creating more. We got bigger, humans got bigger than that. But now they're creating with 2 pounds apart just to have more championship bouts. I mean, it's totally degraded. But it was a wonderful world I went in. But the big thing about it, it taught you independence. You were on your own. Everything.
So what age did you start there?
12.
12, okay, 12. Yeah.
I just loved it. It just enriched my life. You know, I mean, I read a lot and that sort of thing. But I realised now I was different from the other chaps, and I put a lot of that down to boxing. I mean, we had compulsory military training at school every Tuesday. The army issued uniforms. I took mine home and burnt it. They made the mistake of calling my mum to the school. She wouldn't say so, but I knew she was pleased when she heard what I'd done. She was a natural rebel. And she gave him a bollocking. And in the end, it was agreed. If I stopped hanging out the quad window at 9-0 College and singing abuse at them, left, right, this sort of thing. I mean, the whole regimentation. But it was the same again when we had compulsory military training, of course, 3 months. They sent me the call up when I was 17 and a half. I thought about it. I wrote back. I said, this is a very bad idea for you, me coming in, and it's a very bad idea for me, therefore I won't be coming. So they sent me conscientious objection forms, and it wasn't conscientious objection. So I thought, no, I'm not. I said, no, you don't get it. I'm not coming. I don't want to come. So I won't be coming. Well, I came home one day in our little state house, and there were two young soldiers here to arrest me. God, that was funny. And I was a belligerent little bugger. I said,
oh, you
make my day. Who's going first? Come on, they looked at one another. Mum, right, you've heard what he's got to say. Out you go. They couldn't get out there quick enough, so I went to the two hard basket.
Oh, really? And they just thought, oh, bugger it.
Yeah, I'm in the two hard basket with a number of government agencies.
Bob's interest in boxing went far beyond the amateur ring. Having authored many books on the subject and managed professional fighters, including New Zealand's Joseph Parker, Bob has always been a larger-than-life character and has famously thrown a few punches outside the ring throughout his life, most notably when he punched TV reporter Rod Vaughan on live television in 1985. And for those interested in that story, yes, I did ask Bob, and I'll include his hilarious response at the end of the interview. But now, I ask him how boxing led him to meeting and befriending Detective John Hughes.
So where did you run into Johnny? At what age?
Well, you see, I was so embroiled in boxing, and that carried. I won the NZU lightweight title in Dunedin, all these sort of things, and it was just such a rich experience. But because I knew them all, I knew everybody. Well, 1958, it was a big thing in those days, New Zealand amateur champs. They would command very full reporting in the press, you know. Bear in mind, we didn't have television and that sort of thing then. And they were held in Wellington Town Hall. And I decided not to compete because, my nose was buggered. I was a good defensive boxer, but, I was confined to left hand only because my right arm was smashed up and badly. But anyway, I divert. And I still can see Johnny right now winning the New Zealand light middleweight title in the ring. I can still picture him back then. It's funny. The older you get, I'm 84, and the older you get, you forget names and all that sort of thing, which I read a report on that. Don't worry about it. It's normal at 84. It's when you start calling them by the wrong names, you've got a problem. But what I do find interesting, the further back I go, the more I can trot out accurate pinpoint detail, names of things and all this sort of thing. I could tell you the names of all my school teachers starting at, since 1945, Mrs. Ryder, this sort of thing. And, yeah. I can still picture Johnny in the town hall. He was a good boxer, not special, but a good boxer, correct boxer, winning the light middleweight title. I can still see him in his blue Auckland outfit and this sort of thing. So, I mean, I knew everybody in boxing and I knew him. And I was president of the South Pacific Boxing Association. And we were out the back in the dressing room of a major bout one night. And Johnny was there and I was there. How he got it, I don't know. But he was a boxing personality. And we got talking about the... this is what led to the discussion about the Thomas thing.
Yeah.
So that sort of dates it a bit.
When he says the Thomas thing, Bob is referring to the case of Arthur Allen Thomas, who was convicted of the double murder of Harvey and Jeanette Crewe in 1970. It's one of New Zealand's most well-known cases, due to the revelation that crucial evidence against him had been planted by police, most notably a bullet casing. Thomas was pardoned in 1979 after 9 years in prison, and the case remains unsolved. And one of the young detectives working on that case was none other than John Hughes.
And he said, listen, trust me. I still remember what he said to me. Do you believe in professional, what's the term he used? Professional gut instinct. Instinct's the wrong word. He should have said intuition, but this is a commonly misused word for intuition. Yes, Johnny, I said, I do. And he said, well, I'm telling you, the bastard did it. That's why I planted the bullet for Thomas. But it's not good enough.
Yeah.
You know, it's just not good enough. And I told him a story, but we had a hell of a row, and we didn't speak for a while.
So you're in the back room of a boxing match or something, and after...
We never saw the boxing match. We argued right through the duration of it. Fighter left for the... out and came back afterwards. We found out what had happened, but we argued throughout. I mean, I told him a story. It didn't make any difference how my life would have been ruined if it wasn't for chance.
Will you tell me that story?
Yeah. The overwhelming evidence of my guilt.
Here, Bob is referring to a point in his early life where he was very nearly wrongfully convicted of the arson of one of his own buildings. Bob says he would have been done for were it not for the good fortune of the eventual discovery of a witness who is able to identify the real perpetrator, a known arsonist who immediately confessed to the crime. Bob says that without this witness, the circumstantial evidence overwhelmingly pointed at himself, and he would have been jailed, and his life would never have become what it has.
I told him the story about me,
about yours,
and I said, look, no matter all the circumstantial evidence in the world, it's possible. You've got to allow it's possible that you might be wrong. You can't make those, what he called gut feeling, professional gut feeling was his term, that was what he used, judgments. They can guide you to pursue a particular individual, but you just can't rely solely on that.
Yeah,
I do. He asked me, do you respect professional gut feeling? Of course I do. You know, we all apply that in our lives every day. But we had a big falling out. We never spoke for a while, and then the Tamihere case came up, and what I was reading in the paper, I didn't think they had anything on him. So I was quite surprised to read they'd convicted him.
When you said you and Johnny didn't talk for a time.
Well, you see, so there I was, after breaking up with Anne, and it was the last hurrah with young, well, it turned out it wasn't, but I assumed it was, with a young woman. In the 90s, you know, it was the Saturday night after, and I was at a big party in Auckland. And I was dancing with this bloody young girl, pretty girl. And all of a sudden, I'm jerked from behind, and Johnny was drunk. And he'd been sitting with a bunch of bloody lower court judges. Everyone was drunk. He was drunk. And he pulled me, just the bastard I want to talk to. And I said, oh, hello, Johnny. He said, I got bloody Tamihere yesterday. I said, yeah, well done. Yeah, you know, I can only rely on the newspaper reports. I didn't think you had anything on it. He said, I didn't. But you listen to me, and he jabbed me in the chest. I'm telling you, the bastard did it. He got him on 3 points, and he said, I made every one of them up, but the bastard did it. Well, of course, they all unraveled, as you know, all those 3 points that he'd come up with. And he was a worry to the police, but he was effective.
Did you speak to Johnny much after that time when you saw him?
No, I never spoke to him again after that, but if I recall rightly, I don't think I ever did.
So you, when you had that sort of falling out, that was a real falling out sort of thing, and you really...
Yeah, I mean, look, it was a Lavasa, you won't remember that name, fight. He was a very clever Samoan middleweight, but he wasn't much of a puncher, so his bouts went the distance mainly. He was a very, very clever athlete. So it would have been an hour out there, I guess, from the time he left. And we were alone in the dressing room before they came back and it broke it all up, you know. And then, of course, this, etc. I knew his brother. Although I haven't spoken to him in years. He lived in Australia. I knew him through boxing.
Given what you know of Johnny and what his character was, is he the kind of cop that you want on the street? You know,
That's a tough question. Yes, in a way, and no, in a way. You know, but there are reasons for both. Yes, we want a bloke that nails people, that's passionate about it. He just had a hatred of crime. Well, we should all have a hatred of crime. See, he was a long distance runner. It was a zealous man, you know, he did everything with passion. You know, when I say long distance, you understand what I mean by that.
Yeah, he did
Sydney to Melbourne, all that.
Yeah.
I always remember the Sydney to Melbourne one because I teased him about that once. So, yeah, I teased him about that. And that might have been after the... I might have met him, but I don't know. But, the Auckland to Wellington and all that sort of... he had that glint of the drug addict in his eyes of too much exercise. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He did everything with passion and too much zealotry and not enough thinking.
Yeah.
Well, it's not enough just reflection, if you like. That's probably a better word, reflection at times. And look, it's a tricky one. They're in an invidious position. But, you know, the police approved of what he was doing, the beating up of the drug addicts, but it frightened the shit out of him that it'd be exposed. He just was passionate about getting criminals. I don't think it was the thrill of the hunt or anything like that with him. I don't think it was anything like that. I don't think he was a rotten cop like many are that just throw their weight around. He just hated crime.
And I assume people getting away with things.
And getting away with it.
Yeah. And I mean, you could understand that.
Mm.
I could imagine how, and I mean, we're talking about a different time, you know, in the 80s, the 90s and 70s. It's a different time to now. And
fuck it, I'm going to have a glass of wine, and so are you.
Okay. What's your normal?
It'll cheer me up. You have a red or white?
I'll have a red if.
Good.
Oh, yeah. Just grab that. Yes, yeah, so like you said, I think you said in an email you sent to me that, you know, you wanted to be clear that he wasn't a bad cop in terms of that he would stitch up people that he didn't believe.
This is funny. He'll
he
come in and say
a person that didn't do something. It would be someone he genuinely, well, as far as
oh
he
yeah,
was
Johnny
concerned.
Would never, never, ever frame anyone.
Yeah,
he would never frame someone in the sense of, you know, framing an innocent person. He had his own honesty in that respect, but he.
Thanks, Bob. He would just sort of help a case get over the line if necessary.
Oh, he couldn't stand them getting away with it, and getting away with it repeatedly. And of course, a murder. Is it okay?
Yeah, yeah, that smells good.
Murder was a very serious crime. He couldn't stand people getting away with things like murder.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
A fellow detective once put it this way. There are some heavy, bad hoods out there who respect him to the point of fear. And I'll ask you the same question I asked Bob. Is John Hughes the type of cop you want to see on the streets? Someone who ruthlessly pursues criminals, who believes in professional gut instinct. And what are we to take from Bob's last meeting with John, where he poked him in the chest and said that Tamahiti was guilty, but I made up all the evidence? We know today that Conchi Harris's jailhouse evidence was fabricated. At one point, Harris even claimed that police had offered him $100,000 to do so, although no evidence of this was ever found. Did Hughes get to Harris? There's no doubt that his evidence played an important role in Tamahiti's eventual conviction. Is this the evidence that he made up? Perhaps. Or is there something more? Maybe evidence that to this day is still believed to be legitimate. I can only speculate. But for myself, there have always been huge question marks around the convenient timing of the discovery of Heidi's jacket and her Barnes wallet on the trail to Crosby's clearing. A discovery that seriously bolstered the then struggling police case. We also have the bizarre discovery of the tent in the shed at the end of Tararoo Creek Road 9 months after the murders. A shed that had been searched not once, but at least twice by police. It's also worth noting that both of the lone men who discovered these separate items had been involved with police and Hughes prior to the items being found. I'm certainly not saying that either of these men was involved in the planting of evidence. But given the mystery surrounding their discovery in areas already searched, their importance to the police case, and Hughes's own comments to Bob Jones. We do have to ask ourselves, if there was fabricated evidence, what was it? I had a fantastic afternoon sitting with Bob in his beautiful office overlooking central Wellington. We spoke for hours, and it really was a privilege to soak up a bit of that larger-than-life character that is Sir Bob Jones. There's no filter with Bob, and I love that. Every story has another story, and it strikes me how much this man has fit into his life. He tells me that he's always loved architecture and buildings. Some people collect stamps, Bob says. Well, I like collecting buildings. Bob even tried his hand in politics in the early 80s when he founded the New Zealand Party. And it was through this that we came to a question I really wanted to ask.
Tell me the story about the time you punched the journalist who came out, you were fishing. Were you out Wainui Umata?
No, that was at Turangi.
Oh, because I read about the story and it sounded bloody funny.
I didn't punch a journalist. I laid out three of them. Anyway, so we agreed we would announce the party was pulling stumps. It was duly announced. I was up at my Turangi fishing home. I spent 2 days full-time doing interviews on the phone explaining, but I refused to talk to Television New Zealand, and I refused to talk to the Auckland Star that Bridie hadn't taken over then to ruin, but was about to. The reason I wouldn't talk to TVNZ is I had written to, what's his name? Has he died yet? I don't think so. The God Boy.
Not sure.
Wrote The God Boy. He was head of TVNZ, and I knew Ian. He was a nice fellow. I said, why won't you people give us any coverage? And he'd written back saying, because you're not really that relevant anymore. Well, if we're not relevant, don't talk to me. I spent 2 days, all of a sudden we are relevant. But anyway, so I spent 2 days non-stop doing telephone interviews with journalists. The print medium, the radio, TV, the whole, and not TVNZ. When they rang, I said, no, your boss said we don't count, so stick to it.
Yeah.
Well, and at the end of 2 days, I used to get up in the morning at 4:00, you're allowed to fish from 5 to 11 at night. I'd get up at 4. Well, the night before, on Tuesday night, I'd spent 2 days. Now, my place had a bloody big wall around it, about 8 feet high. There was a knock on the door at 11 o'clock. And I'll take it. And she rushed the door. And I shout out, what's going on? What's going on after about 3 minutes? And she knew I'd react violently. And she's trying to get two of these bastards, they were Auckland Star journalists, had climbed over my fence and knocked on my door at 11 at night. I refused to talk to them because they campaigned hard against the New Zealand Party all the time. Their journalists did. So, fuck you, you treated us really badly. We're not prepared to talk to you. I get up at 4 the next morning. It was a bit of a ritual, I pull myself into my waders, sort of thing. I would, the rod was strapped on the car, and I always put my fishing hat, which I still have, with all the tins of flies and that, on the roof while I'm getting dressed, the roof of the car. They weighed it down, and big, heavy, warm hat, because it's winter time, winter fishing. Then I'd walk out to the gates and open it. It was a beautiful home, two-story, beautiful, beautiful home. And open the gates, and I would then go back to the car, put the hat on, drive out. I opened the gates, and these fucking three journalists, TVNZ, Rod, he was a current affairs journalist, came running in. No, sorry, he wasn't there. The two Auckland Star journalists came running in. They've been waiting. Whether all night, I don't know.
They're leeches, aren't they?
Oh, I saw red. I got in the fucking car, forgetting about the hat on the car.
Oh, no.
But it had all these fly tins weighing it down. And I shot out, and one of them tried to jump in front, so I went for him, sent him flying. They were big buggers. Oh, fuck him. He's on my property if he wants to run in front of my car. Sent him flying. He was lucky. And then off they jump in their car. They're chasing me down the road at 5 a.m, you know, quiet road, wide road. And I'm watching them behind me. And then I see my hat fly off. I was sentimental about that. I still have it. I stopped. One of them, they stopped. They grabbed the hat. He's pulling up from me. Smack, the old left hook. Broke his nose.
He's got the hat. Broke his nose. Ripped the hat off of you.
He had it. No, they'd stopped and grabbed it.
Right.
Oh, we won't give it to you, this sort of thing, until you do an interview.
Fucking arsehole.
Fuck, in with a left hook. Then I went for the other bastard, and he put his... Fuck, he had the camera. He put his camera up. Really damaged my hand. Hit him. But it still bruised his face. And I went out, had a great day fishing. I was having to put my hand in the bloody water all the time. It was a bloody mess. I was right down the bottom of the river. Then I came home, and there's bloody three cops sitting in there, all with bloody glass of wine, and Anne. And they said, oh, Jesus, Jones, one of them's got a broken nose and that, and you're going to have to bloody... and meanwhile, what's his name from TVN said, come in with a helicopter thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've got all these buggers that you've knocked about it, but he got a broken nose. What was his name? Rod Vaughan.
Oh, okay, maybe that's the one.
Yeah, and his nose was broken. I told him years later, you look better with it, mate, you know, with this bump.
Gives you a bit of character.
But he, and we've got three of them, and they all sort of damaged a bit, and we're going to have to prosecute. Oh, God, here's the good side of the police.
Yeah.
The prosecution took place in Rotorua. 2 days beforehand, Vaughan's pilot had come to us and said, I want to give evidence, which he did. He said, I told him, this plane I can use, he said, I bought, it's a Russian plane, I bought, when they bought it to shift bulldozers down the west coast, and they no longer had a use, nobody wanted it. So it was so cheap, I bought it. He said, but it's fucking frightening. It's incredibly noisy. You want me to chase Jones up the river, it would be pretty frightening, the noise. Are you sure? He's asked us to come and find him. Now, Anne was 9 months pregnant. She was a very calm person. She was outside in the garden doing some weeding. It was a beautiful property. When they hovered over here, and for her to behave as she did, there was a rifle inside, a 22. She went inside and got it and pointed at him. She was so terrified with the noise hovering over it. Then off they went looking for me. And I'm standing waist deep, and all of a sudden I hear this noise, all of a sudden it's right over me, beating up the water. I've never been so frightened. The noise was horrendous. It was just above my head. And I fought my way out and dived into a fucking bush. I was taking thorns out of me a month later. And then there was a God. They landed. I was over there. You've seen those shots of me racing towards
you. I haven't seen photos.
You can dig it up on the computer. Of me racing towards Rod Vaughan as he, and bang, over he went, broken nose.
Mr. Jones is currently staying at his holiday home just north of Turangi. When we phoned him today, we were told he was out fishing and wouldn't be back until early this evening. So we chartered a helicopter to try and find him. It was our intention to interview him about the events over the past few days regarding the decision to put New Zealand's third most popular political party into recess. Mr. Jones was in the lower reaches of the Tongariro River. As we arrived overhead, he left the river and we landed on the river bank. But before we could speak to him, Mr. Jones ran out of the trees and towards the camera. As well as my injury, the cameraman Peter Mayo was knocked to the ground and bruised. Meanwhile, Mr. Jones went back into the bush.
And then the pilot said, fuck this, and he flew away. He left
him.
But the pilot was furious. He said it would have been terrifying. They assured me that Bob knew that and that he was looking forward to me and that they lied. And of course, I got fined a grand and convicted, because that's when I said to the judge, make it two and I'll do it so I can do it again. Save the court a lot of trouble. He didn't take kindly to that. Years later, I got a television call from TVNZ. They said, Rod's retiring from TV and we're doing a bloody valedictory thing for him and having a party for him. Can we come and see you and get your opinion? I said, certainly not. Oh, well, we understand. I said, but you can do better than that. Don't tell him. Come on round. They came round. They filmed it. He loved it. He wrote me a lovely letter. He said, you floored me. You floored me 8 years or 6 years ago in the banks of the Tongariro, and you floored me again when I watched this. Apparently, they had all these people that had gone and pestered, you know, ex-politicians to say a few nice words, and they'd all stood around, you know, at this party and listened to bloody buggers saying platitudes. And then the film showed them coming up my drive and my home, which they all knew what it was. So booing broke out, you know, out of sympathy with Ron. Yeah. Everyone started booing. Then it showed it. It was bloody marvellous. Knock, knock on the door. I answer it, yes, Rod Burns retiring. Do you have anything you want to say? No. Well, he's got a message for you. Do you have a message for him? He's got a message for you. So she goes, bang, you know, I trained. And so the next shot, I'm lying unconscious on the floor with this bloody big street. And it went down a treat. They just loved it. You know, it was good fun. Yeah. I mean, you know, get over it. It doesn't matter. But I remember these other two bastards came up to me. One of them did at a function once and said, look what you did to my nose. So I said, you should be grateful to me. You look better for it. He said, a lot of people tell me that, actually. I mean, but that's what happened with the Rod Vaughan thing.
It's quite an honour to be punched by Bob Jones.
I'll get killed.
Outside of the room.
I'll get killed. I chased a bastard down here about 2 weeks ago. It was about parking, and I couldn't get in the park. He held us all up for about 10 minutes. I shouted abuse at him, and he shouted abuse back. I just saw red. I came out of the car, and off he went. Yeah, I'll get killed one day. I keep forgetting I'm 84.
Bob was eventually convicted on 4 charges of assault for famously punching the reporters. And it is true that when the judgment was given, Bob asked the judge if he could pay $2,000 so that he could do it all over again. In 2015, Bob was removed from an Air New Zealand flight by security staff for failing to follow crew instructions. Then, subsequently, Jones went and bought a private jet, and he tells me it was the best thing he ever did. Bob Jones is a character, that's for sure. I really hope you've enjoyed this candid interview with Bob Jones and that you've been able to take something from it. So I want to say a big thank you to Sir Bob himself and his team, Aaron, for setting this up. Thanks very much.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.